We love hip hop.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Okay. Your audio is super clear. Perfect. Perfect. Perfect.
Okay. In a new space, so I got to test it out.
Very nice space. Listen, before we even start, and I already have the recording process starting here, I always like to compliment guests on the backdrops that they have when we do our interviews on Zoom.
Okay, good. Good. So, it's a piece I had custom made from Israel, actually.
Nice, nice.
Thank you. Thank you. I like your shirt.
Thank you. Thank you. It's courtesy of Villain Collection, you know what I mean? A local clothing line.
Oh, I love it.
So let's get into it. I know you don't have a lot of time. So I'm really like doing interviews with artists. However, with the city that I live in, a lot of the artists that I've interviewed over the years, specifically rappers, I'll say, have had a lot of issues, let's say. Right?
Yeah.
And over time, I've not only interviewed artists, I've interviewed, you know, people behind the scenes, and I've interviewed people who work in the legal field. Okay. So I like to get all different sides of the story. So this is why I felt that this was, beneficial to our audience and necessary for us to do today. Right. So with no further ado, we have, winner of the, or top 10 lawyers, in criminal law as given by her peers. Okay. Defender of justice and, you know, somebody who knows, the people who she's defending from her own life experiences. We have Jordana Goldlist in the building.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show. It's great.
No, thank you. And just, you know, the fact that, you know, you're aware of the We Love Hip Hop Network. I appreciate that as well. You know what I'm saying? I want to get into it right off the top here. One of the things I mentioned that you were voted top 10 lawyers by your peers. Can you explain that to our audience here?
I'm not sure where you're getting that from. I'm voted one of the top lawyers in Canada. It's a peer-based system. I'm not sure where I rank on the scales, but for me, it was certainly an honor and an achievement because I know the work that I do and I know the appreciation I get from my clients, mm-hmm. but it's nice to know that I'm also recognized among peers in the legal industry. For the most part, I practice in my lane. I try not to focus on what other people are doing, try not to pay attention. I do things a little bit different and I'm glad that I do. So yeah, when I realized that peers and other lawyers and other, you know, industry professionals are recognizing the work that I do, it means something different. It's nice.
Yeah. And, you know, always just, you know, as somebody who works in the broadcast field and getting recognized by your peers is just something that it just gives you that extra battery in your back as well. When you go to do your job too, you know what I'm saying? You know, you're making a difference when the people around you, it's kind of hard to give props to people who are kind of working with you, but when they do, it's like, okay, I must be doing something right.
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't want to say competitors because there's room for so many of us and it's not like we're all competing for one place. We're not. We all try to carve out our different niche and serve, you know, a different client base, which is nice. But when those around you that are sort of in that similar sphere recognize you, you're right. It means something different. It's like, oh, you know what? I'm on a good path here. I'm on a good trajectory and I like it. And it does. It motivates you to do more and do better and find a different way to service people, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And before we get into like some of the history points that I want to touch on today, I watched or I've been going through your Instagram, right? Like you first kind of popped up on my radar via Keep Six Solid from one of the cases that you successfully defended, right? But when I started going through your page and seeing your posts and you giving, you know, doing different explanations of law and different things like that, I'm hearing beats in the background and a lot of them are classic hip hop beats.
Yeah.
Are you high key? Cause I don't even say low key. Are you a hip hop head?
Oh yeah. Since I was a kid. So, I was probably 8 or 9 years old playing basketball.
Okay.
And one of the kids on the court called me over and handed me two cassettes. That's how old I am. Cassette tapes. One was Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A. and the other was Easy Does It by Eazy-E.
Wow.
And those little, you know, 8-9-year-old me that was not in that world, to hear that, to hear what was happening in a different side of life. First of all, the music moved me, but the message also. And hearing about issues that were so far removed from my life and my experience, it really changed the way that I interacted, you know, with the world around me. And those lessons stuck for sure.
Yeah, no, that's dope. Like, and it's, you just gave me chills when you mentioned those two as your entry points into hip hop.
Yeah.
Because we're basically in the same generation, because those are my entry points into hip hop too. You know what I mean? Like, listening to N.W.A. was like, oh my God, this is what's going on. Like, this is the streets. Like, holy smokes.
Right. No, yeah.
That's dope. That's,
for me, it was them. Public Enemy way back when.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like an entry point. Big Daddy Kane. So yeah, that's what I grew up with. That's what I sort of came of age with. And it always stuck. I always felt an affinity to hip hop. You know, as a teenager, it certainly diversified a little bit, you know, the alternative music, rock music, but hip hop has always been my roots. So yeah, I want my Instagram page and what I do to reflect, you know, who I am. And that's certainly part of it.
Okay. So the pieces are coming together now. You know what I'm saying? And listen, I'm going to let you know, I've done my research. I watched through a multitude of interviews and listened to some of the podcast episodes that you did. Right. So I want to make sure that when we do it over here at the We Love Hip Hop podcast, that we touch on some of those different things, like the hip hop and part, you know, just you being part of the urban community, because I don't know if you know, like you're in our urban community. You know what I'm saying? You're one of us.
I love it.
Right? You've defended a lot of different rappers who I've previewed on my network as well as interviewed myself. You know what I'm saying? But before we even get into that, right? Where did you grow up? Because that's where I didn't find in my research. Like, what ends, as they say?
So it really depends what point of my life you want to focus on. So my childhood was like Thornhill, Richmond Hill.
Okay.
So the first few years of my life were in Thornhill, then moved up to Richmond Hill. Then in my sort of early teens, I was downtown living in the Annex, but I started high school at East Hill Collegiate at Broadview and Girard. So experienced a very, very different life. And then got shipped back up to Richmond Hill. So I had to readjust from, you know, essentially Regent Park, Moss Park, up to Richmond Hill, which is a completely different walk of life.
Yeah.
About a year and a half up there floating through different schools before the York Region Board of Education expelled me completely. And then was back downtown throughout my teens, and then back to Thornhill in my 20s when I finally made it back into school. So where I'm from is sort of originally Thornhill, Richmond Hill, so North Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
My adventures throughout my early years certainly took me all over the place.
Yeah, and you know, all of that moving around, there's different reasons, right? For example, you got kicked out of your home at 14 years old and had to start living in group homes.
Yeah. So the day after I turned 14, my mom sent me into to youthdale facilities. So I spent 21 months in group homes. So that's where I started. That's how I started high school. I started high school at Eastdale Collegiate, living in youthdale. And then when I finished my stint with them, back home to Richmond Hill, things really didn't work out very well. And then on my own from like 17 to 20.
So let's stop there for a second and unpack, as they say. Prior to that age 14 time, what were you doing that made your mom say get out of the house or like put you into the group home in the first place?
Yeah, so it wasn't that she was kicking me out of the house. She was trying to get me help, quite frankly. I had sort of like a dark side to me, you know, was from a broken home at a time where broken homes weren't really acceptable, weren't really acknowledged, you know, going back. I'm almost 44. So, you know, parents split when I was two.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in an environment where that wasn't acceptable. You know, now it's standard. Now, you know, parents not being together is probably the norm rather than the exception.
Yeah.
The fact that it's different. And so that fracturing of the family environment really started, you know, breaking issues with me. So I was acting out, not so much in school. I always could hold it together in school. So it's funny. I was never suspended, just completely expelled from an entire board of education. So I've never done things small, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I lived a very self-destructive life from a really young age, started smoking, doing drugs, just running around with the wrong crowd. And so my mom putting me in the group home wasn't to send me away. It was to try to get me help to address some of these underlying issues, you know, and it's ironic because it's what I preach now as a lawyer. When people say, how do we fix these issues of criminality and gun violence and gang violence? And I say, you've got to address underlying issues. And so, yeah, I know that not only because of what I interact with my clients, but what I experienced myself. You can't slap a Band-Aid on a problem and hope that it heals unless you're actually caring for the wound. And so that's what she tried to do. Unfortunately, UTL was not the facility to provide help. Their structuring made things far more problematic for me. And so when I came home, instead of, you know, reintegrating with my peers in Richmond Hill, I was really just looking to get out as quickly as I could. And so it created further tension, led to issues at school, led to arrests.
Wow.
And the story unfolds.
I'm writing down right here what I call bars that you said. You can't slap a Band-Aid hoping that it heals. Can you repeat the end of that again?
You can't slap a Band-Aid on a problem hoping it heals. You need to fix the wound underneath.
You need to fix the wound underneath. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely, definitely. And you came home around 16 years old, but then you ended up in Vanier. And this is crazy because I'm speaking to a lawyer. So this is something I had no idea was possible. And for people who don't know what Vanier is in the audience or maybe outside of Canada, that's the women's detention center over here in Toronto, right? So can you explain like to us like the process of even getting into there in the first place and then what it was like as a young woman in there?
Yeah, so before I went into UTL, I had a lot of freedom. I was the only child. I was a latchkey kid. Both of my parents worked. So I'd come home from school. You know, I'd go to the basketball courts, play with my friends. I had freedom. And UTL took all of that away. And so my way of coping with their rules and their system was that I started getting high. And I learned that as a coping mechanism for all of life. And so when I came back from UTL after, you know, quote unquote, graduating, I came home with a really serious drug problem. And so started using every day. I was arrested, I don't know, probably a year after I got home. And then again, within 3 or 4 months, I was arrested on school property. By that point, tensions with my mom had grown to such an extent that, you know, she would throw me out of the house for 3-4 days. I would have to go and find shelter. I was 15 at the time. Mm-hmm. And then she would call the police looking for me. She didn't actually want me to leave. She just wanted me to stop misbehaving. And so I needed to find ways to support myself. And so, of course, I started selling dope. That's what you do when you're a drug addict. And I got caught. I got caught on school property. And because it was my second arrest in 3 months, the police wouldn't just release me. My mom wanted to teach me a lesson and not bail me out. And so she let me sit. It wasn't for long, but certainly long enough to learn not to get caught again. And for me, it was, you know, 4 or 5 days, I think, in solitary confinement. Now, you got to understand, I'm 16 years old.
Wow.
We're just talking about marijuana. We're not talking about like serious drugs or serious quantities. I'm selling dimes just to pay my friend's dad to let me sleep on the couch at night. Like,
yeah.
Not serious weight here.
Petty stuff.
Petty bullshit. And for reasons I'll never understand, Vanier deemed me a risk to myself or others and sent me into solitary confinement for 4 days.
Solitary confinement for dime bags. That's crazy.
Nothing. Small. $40. I had, I think, 5 or 6 dime bags and $40 in cash at high school. Like, I was on school property, just trying to make enough money to pay for a place to sleep that night.
They were trying to do some scared straight stuff on you.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. And even with that, right? Is that the time when you were expelled from school and you appealed your expulsion?
Yeah.
Break that down to me, please. Because that's early foreshadowing of the getting into the legal field.
Yeah. So back then, and it may still be the case, York Region Board of Education, what's called a zero tolerance policy. So anybody who was caught selling drugs or committing violence on school property was automatically expelled from the entire school board. So here I was, a straight A student. I was always really good in school if I could just focus enough to get there. And so straight A student, and they're expelling me from the entire board. And I thought, no, you're not kicking me out of a board. I may not want to go to school, but you're sure as hell not going to tell me I can't be there. That's the decision I'm going to make. That summer I turned 17. I took on the entire board, argued my case as to why I thought I shouldn't get expelled. They changed their decision such that I was only expelled from the school I was selling at, and they let me back in to one of the other schools. And as a testament to how much I did not want to actually be in school, I dropped out that same year.
Wow. you definitely were showing the determination from a young time. And also another foreshadowing with the law stuff, right? And I'm going to go back a little bit before we go forward. At 7 years old, you saw your first, like, I guess, real legal or lawyer really dealing with a case from, like, one of your family members.
Yeah.
Okay, so can you explain that to our audience over here who might have not heard that story?
Yeah, so I was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, and one of my family members got arrested. And I remember the night vividly. It was complete chaos in the house. And of course, the family hired the best lawyer they possibly could. Everyone sort of came together and pitched in. And for the next year and a half, that lawyer was like God in the household. Mm. Anytime the phone rang, it was all the lawyers on the phone. You know, if I wanted to do something, I needed something. No, sorry, honey, we got to go see the lawyer. No, we got something with the lawyer. I didn't understand what a lawyer did. I did not understand the job. I did not understand the qualifications. All I understood was how important this human was to our family and how appreciative my family was, you know, when he beat the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I wanted. That's what attracted me initially to the title of lawyer. I didn't even understand the justice elements. I didn't understand, you know, the ability to fight for the underdog. I didn't understand, you know, the legal arguments that we could be making. It was really just about being that important that you can change the course of someone's life. And what that meant for me as a child watching my family go through it. And that's what planted the seed for me to want to be a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of even helps with the way that you operate. And, you know, from what I've heard from interviews, how you get to know your clients. It's not just like, this is just one of my clients. Like, you got to get to know your client to be able to represent them properly. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of foreshadowing from when you were a kid. Like, you guys pretty much probably got to know that lawyer pretty well.
Actually,
and vice versa.
Makes me want to get to know my clients and not just treat them like files is how I was treated when I got arrested. Mm. So I've been arrested twice, and I was never offered the opportunity to review my disclosure. I was never told about what a trial is. I was never given options. I was, you know, obviously intelligent enough to fight the entire York Region Board of Education myself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I never had my legal aid duty counsel lawyer explained to me what the process was. And when I finally realized, when I got to law school and realized what's involved, you know, in having someone plead guilty and what the ramifications could be and what the options were, I was appalled at how I was treated. And so I promised myself that, you know, not that it's in my disposition to ever be like that to someone, but to go that extra mile. And so even now when I do, you know, initial consults with people, even if they're not hiring me,
yeah,
I explain what the process is. I explain what disclosure means. I explain what their options are as part of that first interview, because I don't want anyone to walk away, whether they hire me or not, being in the dark about what they can and cannot do within the system. So I think that comes from the way I was treated when I was going through it myself.
Oh, that's amazing. And even like to go back to in your teenage times, right? At 19, you went homeless, right? Do you think that was like your rock bottom? Because I feel after that, that's when your turning point came.
Yeah, yes and no. So no, I left home at 17. Mm-hmm. So after I was expelled, I was still at home. I was sort of bouncing around. And then after I left school permanently at 17, I also left home within the same week.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely hit my bottom in those next few years.
Yeah.
A few months before my 19th birthday, I had a near fatal drug overdose, which was probably very close to the bottom.
Wow.
3 months later, I was out using again, certainly hit my bottom. At 19 years old, I went into rehab for 6 months, came out clean, stayed clean more or less for about 2 years, and then started using again in undergrad.
Mm.
And I actually didn't completely change my lifestyle until my first semester of law school. And that's when I really had to make this decision. I was in this complete fork in the road where I had to choose lifestyles.
And
so it was a bit of a roller coaster. And I think that's important because I think some people struggle and they think like, oh, it's just one trajectory. When you make that decision to change your lifestyle around, stop using drugs, get help, whatever, you know, the issues are, a lot of people think that you go on this straight path trajectory upwards. And I think that's rarely the case. I think mm-hmm. a lot of time there's a roller coaster ride and there's, you know, some stops and starts at the beginning until you finally realize, no, I've got to make a permanent change in a different direction.
Oh, definitely. And you started studying law and you got your bar over at Osgoode Law School?
Yeah, so I earned a 4-year philosophy degree at York University mm-hmm. first. So I didn't go back to high school until I was 20. I graduated high school at 21, went straight into university for 4 years.
That's
and
dope.
Then at 25, yeah, and then at 25, I started at Osgoode Hall Law School, graduated at 27, and then got called to the bar at 28 years old.
Now, before you started getting into law, right, being somebody who has a criminal past, was that ever a deterrent for you, or were you always aware that you could be a lawyer with having a criminal record?
Well, I mean, when I was on the streets, I didn't think I was going to be anything. I thought, you know, I'm just going to live and die this rock bottom existence. And then, you know, woke up out of that at 19. And no, I thought for sure I'm not going to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went back to school, I assumed that the life that I had just lived, you know, for the last 8 or 9 years was going to prevent me from being much of anything. I just knew I needed to do something. And so I went to school because I thought this is what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
And then I started doing well in school and I thought, okay, maybe I'll teach philosophy because I really enjoyed it and I did well. And then I thought maybe journalism because I love to write and I love to travel. But in the back of my mind, there was always like, yeah, but what about law? What about law? And it was this conflict, right? Yeah. Okay. I want to be a lawyer, but even in undergrad, all my friends were still criminals. So I was like, how can I go and be a lawyer if I'm still, you know, living this lifestyle? And then started using again. And so it was always back and forth. And basically, I was in my last year of undergrad and I was applying to do my graduate degree in philosophy. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to throw out these applications for law school because why not?
Sure.
The worst that can happen is I get rejected. You know, and that's always been my mentality. I'm okay with losing. I don't have an ego that like, if I lose something, I'm, you know, destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I always think, let me try. And if I lose, I'll always have a plan B. And so that's what I did. So I applied to 3 law schools just to see what would happen. Osgoode was always my number one choice. And I got accepted everywhere I applied. And then I had to decide between grad school and whether at the University of Guelph, which was really what I wanted, and law school, which was, you know, a once in a lifetime opportunity for me.
Wow. Wow. What a journey, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you're in the legal game. You're a lawyer, right? And here we are on the We Love Hip Hop podcast. Okay. I'm bringing us to where we can intersect. Okay.
Yes.
What was the first time that you represented somebody and you realized this person is a high profile Toronto rapper? Because you've represented a multitude of people who are rappers or quote unquote rappers, because not everybody is really a rapper, but some of these guys really are.
I don't know when I first took stock of that. I mean, I think, you know, I started my career in criminal defense working at a firm that represents a lot of Toronto rappers. So I'm sure it was in the course of working at that firm that I started realizing a lot of the talent that was coming out locally and the cross-section between people who are also getting caught up in the system and started seeing, you know, a lot of the racism that really brings police to the doorstep of these Toronto rappers. Unnecessarily at first instance, it's more where they're growing up than what they're doing initially. And, you know, for me, it was, I guess it's a personality thing as well, right? I came up in the hip hop community. It's always been a part of my life. And so it was really easy to just form that connection with people in that community. And I think that's really where the relationship grows, right? And so I don't focus on like, oh, this is a Toronto rapper, I want to go and represent him. It's more of, I think they're drawn to me because they know that I appreciate and respect the work and their trade.
Yeah.
Right. I don't look at it as like a gimmick. And so for me, it's not about like, oh, let me go and pose with these rappers and put them on Instagram because that's what's going to build my career. I've very quietly for a long time been representing Toronto rappers because I feel like they need good representation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've had clients that have come to me and say, listen, my current lawyer doesn't respect my career at all. They're not trying to get my bail varied so that I can work. They're not letting me, you know, speak about how important it is for me to travel because there's opportunities for me in other countries that don't exist here and they don't seem to care. You know, and I think that when you care about what someone is about and something that's so ingrained in their lifestyle, then you fight harder in order to help them achieve that because you see the end.
Yeah.
And so I think that's been an important part for me to help a community that, you know, has given so much to me, right? I think that music is a form of therapy. Music's a form of release. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been plenty of dark moments where I can throw on a hip hop album and it takes me out of my head into, you know, a better place. And so I think when you have that respect for an artistry like that, it draws in, you know, it's a circular effect, right?
Yeah. No, and I want to say as a representative and an interviewer of a multitude of hip hop artists out here, that's appreciated because it's a real job. And I've been saying this on air for a lot of years. A lot of people don't realize how much money that a lot of these young men and women are making off of their streams and off of their video views, especially when they're really serious about it, that can be the same or be more than what somebody's making at a 9-to-5. So now let's say if they have some kind of legal issues and you don't really consider what they do a real job, how are they supposed to be able to break the cycle?
Exactly. Especially, you know, if it's a talent like any other, right? It's no different than someone who excels at playing basketball or who's an incredible painter. You know, there's so many different art forms that are people's career. That's their love. That's their passion. And quite frankly, like that's their vehicle to financial success. Mm-hmm. So they have the case of standing away of it and you're treating them differently than you would, you know, a medical student, for example. That's a real problem, right? Like, the system, the justice system works really hard to make sure that people can maintain their employment. You know, I look at how many people that get arrested for fraud related charges, sexual based charges, and it's, oh, we've got to make sure that they stay employed.
Yeah.
But why are we doing the same thing with artists, including those in the hip hop community? If you've got bail conditions that don't let you go to the States and you have $500,000 contract waiting for you, that's a problem.
A huge problem, right? And just to one more on the representation of rappers, right? Because as somebody who, you know, I don't want to say specialty, but a lot of your cases deal with people who are dealing with murders, drug cases and different things like that. Is there an extra layer or like some kind of difference that happens because of dealing with rappers? Like, you know, sometimes there's the media aspect or the way that they're treated, you know what I'm saying? As far as like in front of the judge in the courtroom, right? Or the way that the Crown is treating this case.
Yeah, I try to be really careful to keep them out of the media as much as I can. I don't want that attention because my clients don't want that attention, right? Because the last thing they want is the promoter that they're really trying to sign with or, you know, the director of their next video that they want to sign with is going to see, you know, the media blasting about their charges and think twice about hiring them, right? Great point. Because the reality is, like, as much as what they're projecting through their music, record companies don't want to see that, you know, club promoters don't want to see that. They don't want to bring that sort of quote unquote trouble to their doorstep. And so I do, my attention is on keeping it out of the media as much as possible, mm-hmm. unless and until the case is done. Like if you go through my timeline or any of, you know, my articles, there will be nothing about ongoing cases involving someone who's famous because I don't want to bring that attention to them and their families, of course.
Yeah, no, yeah, some great points. And is there any case that you wouldn't take?
Oh, lots of cases. I'm at a point now where I turn away more than I take in. So I don't do any sex-based offenses. Mm-hmm. So I don't do sex assaults, child porn, any of that. I do very few impaired drivings. And again, not because it's like a moral decision. It's just I'm really focused on what I do. I have very few fraud cases, one or two. But it's not really the focus. My focus has always been, from the time I opened up my own practice, on murder, drug trafficking, firearms offenses. So those three have always just been where my focus is at.
Yeah, that's very interesting because, like, you got so many different types of cases that, you know, people would call heinous cases, right? But do you ever receive like threats and stuff like that? Like phone calls, like, yo, how are you representing this person? Like, you know what I mean? Creepy shit.
Yeah, I do. And it's funny because everybody who isn't a part of this lifestyle or isn't a part of this world says, oh, aren't you scared of your clients? No. The only people who have ever threatened me with violence are the families of the victims.
Wow.
In cases. I have had to have court staff who are so worried about my safety walk me to my car after court. And they're not worried about my clients and their family. They're worried about the victims' families attacking me.
That's crazy.
That's where the threats come from. And when I tell it to people, they're shocked because, you know, oh, the victim. And I use that with air quotes on purpose because, yeah, it's the victim's family who can't get to my client for revenge and see me as sort of this representative of what they've done, which is, of course, not at all the case. But those are the threats that I've received. It's never come from my clients or their family, because at the end of the day, you know, I think when you show people a great deal of respect and you fight for them in every possible way available, they appreciate that no matter what the outcome is.
No, that's real talk right there. And, you know, one thing I always wonder, right, because I've been on the other side of I've been in the system, right? Like I've done my time. I've been in the courtrooms and stuff like that. And I'm seeing lawyers talking with each other, the Crowns and the defense lawyers. And y'all will say my friend. Right. Like that's the terminology that y'all are using in the courtroom. Right. But I ask that, like, I say that to say, is there lawyer beef?
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys have lawyer pollies?
Oh, yeah.
What is that? How did that expose this? How did that look?
So, I mean, like I said, you know, when we started, I try to stay in my lane. Right. Like I've always said, I practice like the racehorse. Racehorses wear those blinders mm-hmm. because if they see what the other horses are doing, they fall. So you stay focused on your lane and you do your thing and you get to the end. So I try not to have that, but there's a lot of that. And I try to stay away from it, but you hear it. So there's defense lawyers that hate other defense lawyers. There's defense lawyers that hate Crowns. There's Crowns that hate Crowns, you know, and then don't forget, all lawyers, whether you're a judge or your Crown, that's where judges come from, right? And so judges don't just become judges out of nowhere. They come up after a minimum of 10 years of practice.
Yeah.
So you have some judges who have had 10 years of beef with other lawyers from when they were practicing lawyers that are now sitting on the bench, right? So sometimes you walk into court and you're like, oh, this isn't going to be good. This is a real problem.
You could cut the tension with a knife.
Yes, it's an issue. So, you know, because I've known that is why I always try to stay out of these beefs, because you never know who that friend that you're you know, beefing with as a lawyer is about to put in their application to become a judge. And the last thing you want is to start off with someone on a wrong foot.
Yeah.
But yeah, it exists. I think it's in every walk of life, and law is competitive. Mm-hmm. And you've got a lot of ego in the courtroom, a lot. I see it often as the sole source of competition.
Yeah.
You know, and forget, sometimes our job requires us to pit ourselves against the other. So, you know, if you've got two or three co-accused, for example, arrested in a car and there's a firearm found and no one wants to take responsibility and there's no charter argument to just get the firearm excluded, you can get in front of that jury and you've got three lawyers that are trying to point the finger at each other.
Mm-hmm. All defense.
Exactly. It's no choice. And unfortunately, that's sometimes what we have to do. So I've seen lawyers in cases that start off okay, but you get halfway through and it's like the mudslinging doesn't stop, and it doesn't just stay in the courtroom because your ego doesn't allow it.
Yeah. Wow. That's educational. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like these are necessary questions because our audience, you know, they love to watch all the different things and the interviews with the rappers and stuff like that. And, you know, I do news stories that are sometimes when my news stories are tragic based, they fly off the shelf. The algorithm just takes them and throws them into everybody's search. Right. And people comment like crazy, but they never get to really know about the other side of things and then what's going on with y'all as the lawyers that have to deal with all this stuff. And, you know what I mean? One more thing or a couple more things I want to ask, right? There's a you talk about a correlation between the criminal justice system and the economic system being designed to keep people stuck.
Yes.
Can you break that down for us a little bit more?
So there are a lot of community-based organizations that for decades have been trying to teach the government what it will take to maybe not eradicate, but greatly reduce gun and gang violence.
Mm-hmm.
It's not complicated. You know, gun and gang violence is the result of poverty. It's the result of hopelessness. It's the result of poor education. It's the result of single family households. And it's not one of these things. It's a constellation of factors that go together. But there is root causes that will lead some people into that lifestyle. And it often comes from the fact that they believe they don't have another choice. And they feel like this is the only option to them in the community from which they grew up. And it's just rite of passage. This is what you do. And a lot of these guys find themselves stuck, you know, in their 20s, in their 30s, and they don't want to do this anymore. But now so many doors have closed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we know as a society, anyone in this system knows that if you wanted to at least greatly reduce these social issues, you have to fund the problem and you have to fix the problem by presenting real solutions that require money. But instead of funding the solutions that would address the root problem, the government time and time again throws money at what isn't the problem. So the best example I could give right now is all of the money being poured by the Trudeau government into trying to prevent legal gun owners from going hunting and sport shooting.
Mm-hmm.
The government is prepared to spend millions and millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, tracking down legal gun owners and taking away guns that would never have ended up involved in crime. Instead of, if they really wanted to address gun violence, they could. They know the guns are coming from the U.S. They're coming in the same shipments as cocaine and fentanyl and heroin.
Yeah.
We know that. Everybody knows that. This is not rocket science.
Yeah.
Are there purchasers? Sure, but few and far between. So instead of addressing the root causes that would actually help people avoid the system in the first place, which has to happen, you know, somewhere between the ages of 2 and 12, because once you hit 12, you're already, you know, in a position that is harder to intervene.
Yeah.
But if we address those root problems initially, we wouldn't have these issues. We wouldn't have all of these arrests. We wouldn't need to put $112 million into bail compliance, which is what Doug Ford did earlier this week or last week.
Mm-hmm.
$112 million we're going to give to the police force, which is already the second biggest funded police force in North America. Toronto police are in the second most than any other force. It's insane how much money we throw at Toronto police. And crime rates aren't going down. gun violence isn't going down. Homicide rates aren't going down. And so why are we using the same solution to try to fix the same problems that we're not seeing solved?
Yeah.
And so the only thing that I can think of is that because the criminal justice system and the police force generates billions of dollars for society. And so we keep it going and we mask the problems with, you know, we talked earlier about Band-Aids not solving the problems. They don't solve the problems. And yet that's what we keep slapping on the same problems over and over again and ignoring the people in the communities. And there's a lot of phenomenal community support groups mm-hmm. that have been yelling at the government for many, many years. I don't know if you've ever had, you know, Louis March, you mentioned Keep Six organization.
Yep.
You know, Richard Miller is doing an incredible job trying to take these issues to the government and explain what's really needed if they want to help. They're not listening. The reason they're not listening, they're ignoring. And I think if they're ignoring, then the only reason can be because of the money that's being generated from the criminal justice system.
Yeah, the basically, it's a broken system.
Or it's working the way it was designed to.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Right? You just got, you know, I don't like to curse on YouTube, but you just gave me a brain fuck right there saying that because it is designed the way it's supposed to, right?
Yeah, people say it's broken. It's not broken. It's working the way it was initially designed to. It keeps the most vulnerable members of society cycling through the system again and again and again. And the people that profit are the people that are working inside of it.
Yeah. So, and I, this is one of my questions that I have here near the end, right? And you brought us to this with what you explained there, but it's, you kind of gave me an answer that I feel like I'm going to be asking a rhetorical question. Can the system be improved? And if so, how? Like, it's so broken. And if it's already designed, like the way that they've made it, like they have it exactly the way they want it, how can we even improve this?
So, I mean, there has to be a shift in consensus, right? Instead of focusing on locking up more quote unquote criminals, why don't we work on helping people avoid the system in the first place? You know, we have to shift the funding from the criminal justice system to the social system, to the education system, to the healthcare system, right? If we did a better job of fixing those initial issues that are leading people to, listen, we're never going to not have crime. Like, that's a reality. It's been with us. It will be with us from time immemorial.
Yeah.
But if we want to truly decrease crime, then we have to look at the root causes for some people who enter the criminal justice system and do a better job of addressing those root causes. Now, various organizations have been saying this for decades. There have been, you know, different committees that have been giving reports, and we spend millions of dollars hiring judges to go and do these investigations and these reports, and they all come up with the exact same solution and no one's implementing them. So what we need is people in power that actually want to implement a change to what we focus on as far as the criminal justice system. And until that happens, it's not going to be fixed. So with a complete overhaul, could it be fixed? Sure.
Yeah.
Will it happen? I'm not confident.
Yeah, it's going to be tough because it's like you got years and not years, like generations of people who already feel who want it to be the way it is. So who's going to be the one who actually starts turning everybody around and making everybody think different? Like it's a tall order, as they say. For you yourself, right? Where do you see yourself as far as in the legal field 10 years from now? Or do you see yourself in the legal field 10 years from now?
No, I don't see 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't want to be a judge or anything like that?
Oh, no. I don't want to be a judge.
No.
I first of all, I have no poker face. So I just don't. It's actually comical. I have colleagues that I do trials with, and you know, there'll be a crown attorney making some ridiculous submissions and my phone will quietly go off and it will be for my friend in the courtroom with the commentary, fix your face.
Yeah.
They know that the expression on my face is just like lost it. I can't. And so if I was a judge, there's no question that I would not be able to hold my composure on stupid arguments, on bad arguments, on arguments not properly based on the law. And that wouldn't just be coming down on crowns. I mean, I sit in the courtroom and I see what some defense lawyers do to their clients and I want to scream.
Mm-hmm.
I see really poor representation. And, you know, as a judge, you can't really intervene and tell an accused person to go get a better lawyer. But I think that, you know, the person in me and who I am would want to do just that.
Yeah.
So I think I would have a really hard time as a judge. I also think that, you know, you have to listen to a lot of bullshit that I just don't want to put up with. You have no choice in your calendar. You have no choice in, you know, what you do and when you do it. And I'm not sure that I'm really built to work for the government. I think that I enjoy my own autonomy too much.
Mm-hmm.
I love the business side of what I do as much as I love the lawyering. So for me, you know, I know that I've landed in the right place for a number of reasons, but even in terms of what I do.
Yeah.
That said, I'm in the process of finalizing a book, and I hope to be able to put that out. I'd like to write a television series. So there's a lot of things that I'd like to do in media. I really enjoy that. And I think it's an alternative way to get out this underlying message, because I think it's important. And I think, you know, we started off this interview talking about, you know, my childhood, my upbringing, my struggles in the first 25 years of my life, which I think are quite unique in the legal field. Mm-hmm. It's given me such a different perspective, and it's allowed me to form connections with clients, because I just take those experiences with me. I don't judge people. I'm not here to, you know, shake my finger and tell someone that what they're doing is wrong. They come to me with a problem, and I got to fix that problem. I'm not trying to fix the person.
Yeah.
And I think that's a different framework than what a lot of other lawyers do. And it's allowed me to gain a perspective. And with every perspective comes lessons. And I'd like to be able to share those lessons beyond, you know, the scope of what I can do in this field. So, you know, as much as I love what I'm doing, and it's not that I would leave because I'm disheartened by it, I just feel like there's more for me to be able to do with the experiences that I've developed over the course of my life.
Yeah. To reach your full potential. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And I have a guest question, or like an audience question, I mean. It's about the glove compartment, right? It's just, and you know, the audience, like when people knew that I was going to be interviewing a lawyer in any way, I didn't specify who, but I was like, I'm going to be interviewing a lawyer. So somebody wanted to know, do you need to have a warrant to check the glove box or the trunk?
So it depends on the situation, like everything else. And, you know, it's funny because I try to give people information on Instagram, and it can never be perfect because the law is not in any way, shape or form black and white. There's no right or wrong. There's no specific rules. So police generally need a warrant to search anything. But like everything in law, there are exceptions to that. So if I'm driving my car and, for example, I have a gun in the glove box, and I'm driving and I decide that I want to smoke a joint in my car, and an officer either sees me or pulls me over because I also have a broken taillight and comes over to issue me a ticket for the taillight, and they smell marijuana or see marijuana, they are allowed under the Cannabis Act to search the entire car to see if there's other marijuana, including in the glove box, because drivers cannot have marijuana that's readily accessible to them.
Yeah, it has to be in the trunk.
That's why I try to explain. Now, they cannot search the trunk in that situation because as a driver, your trunk is not readily accessible. But your glove box is, your center console is, your backseat is. So all of that is fair game if they see or smell or detect marijuana in the car for any rhyme or reason. And that's new, right? That's under the new Cannabis Act that has given them, you know, this power. And there's a number of lawyers that have tried to challenge it on a constitutional level, and they failed. It keeps getting upheld by the courts. That hasn't made it, you know, to the higher courts yet, and I'm hoping it does. But as it stands right now, that's currently the law. That said, if there's no marijuana and the police are just coming over to issue you a ticket for your broken taillight, no, they have no grounds to search the car.
Yeah.
If they are arresting you in the car for some other reason, for example, there's a warrant for your arrest, if the warrant or the reason for the arrest isn't connected to anything that could be in the car, they can't search. But a search incident to arrest allows them to search the general vicinity around you to see if there's any other evidence of the crime.
Yeah.
It's very fact specific, and I'm not trying to give a typical lawyer answer here.
No. From what I'm getting, it's all scenario based. It's all on the specific scenario that you're dealing with.
It completely is. And right now, because you bring up glove box, you know, I've tried to repeatedly explain to people that what the Cannabis Act allows gives so much leeway to the police to search that your car is the last place you should be smoking a joint. Car is the last place you should be keeping your weed. Like, if you've got it, throw it in the trunk. It takes 2 seconds. It's like an open bottle of alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, see that, and it's fair game for all sorts of behavior that they wouldn't ordinarily be entitled to do without a warrant.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And you know, our audience member, you know, do with that information what you will, sir. Right? No, but thank you for having this conversation here with me. I feel that we got to get a lot of good jewels on you yourself, as well as some stuff that in the legal field and just the way the system works and or doesn't work, right? And I really appreciate you having this conversation with me here today. Let the people know where they can find you, you know, besides the social media, like anywhere, if like websites, anything like that, where you want people to be able to hit you up.
Yeah, I'm very easy to find. You Google my name, my website comes up. The website is jhgcriminallaw.com. You search my name, you will easily get to my website. And on my website is all of my contact information, email, office line, cell phone. I make sure that I'm very accessible. Word of advice, I'm horrible with checking voicemails. So anyone that wants to reach me is best suited sending a text or a call or even a DM will get to me quicker. I monitor my direct messages on Instagram. I don't on TikTok. That's managed by a company. So just put that out there. But anyone looking to get a hold of me, the best way is just through any of the contacts on my website. So it's jhgcriminallaw.com.
Perfect. Perfect.
And with that, I want to thank you for having me on, and thank you for what you do for the community. I mean that. You spread all sorts of information and a variety of topics, and I really think it's phenomenal. So I just want to thank you for having me on the show.
No, thank you. And I appreciate, you know, that warms me to know that like people are out there from all different walks of life taking in the content. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Jordana Goldlist, you know what I'm saying? Another one in the vault right here. Yeah, man, it's your boy Friday Ricky Dread. Make sure to like, subscribe, all that good stuff. We are off of this. Deuces.
We love hip-hop.